mentioned something else. This is
recording.
You're recording. Mind. Okay. I'm happy to be recorded. Thank you. In fact, you know, the classroom of the future is you're all going to put out your digital recorders. I'm going to put out my digital recorder, and it will all just transfer. And that's why classrooms are not really necessary. This is a real diverse set of questions, and probably we're going to need to spend some time one-on-one going through particular stuff, and I'm happy to do that. I'm also happy to share, to discuss and share with you by email after this. So if you don't find, for any reason, your question fully answered, you want to dialogue further, I'm at mark@gamestotrain.com. I have a new book coming out, which is called Don't Bother Me, Mom, I'm Learning, which is about why games are good for kids and why they should be playing them and why you as a parent should be this. And the answer is really they're preparing the kids for the 21st century and for things that are gonna that they're going to need to know and do in the 21st century. A lot of what you've asked I'm going to discuss in my keynote talk. And I don't want to repeat all of that because we'll just eat up all our time here. I did prepare some slides, and they speak to the idea of what the title of this is about, which is course modding, in a sense. And course modding, somebody asked what it meant. It's just a term I made up. And the reason I made it up is just because I thought that there was some convergence between what's going on with young people in the game world in terms of their inventing new ways to do things and what we could do as teachers. So I'm going to run through some of these slides. Most of them I'm going to be using later. But just to give you some ideas. And after that, we can have a little bit of discussion as well, because I think we'll have time. The theme of engagement is really, really important. And that's mostly what I go on. And I'm going to tell, I'll give you a little preview here. I'm sure, get everybody in a bother by disagreeing with the theme of the whole conference, that everybody learns differently. I don't think everybody learns differently. I think, in fact, we all learn, almost all learn the same way. We have preferences and things we like, but what is different for every person is how we get engaged, how we get hooked into the learning process. And so that's one of the reasons why engagement is so important. And I equate engagement, motivation, passion for learning. You could probably differentiate those, but I'm going to conflate them. The reason it's so important that we put in the engagement into what we do is that in the future, content is just going to change on us continuously. You know, I mean, history will remain history, although it will get revised. But basically, things are going to move so fast that the content that's going to come to people in the future is going to change probably yearly, the stuff that people want to know. It's going to go that fast. And therefore, you don't want to spend people, you don't want to teach people content. You want to teach people to learn about content on their own. And the only way people are going to do that on their own is if they're engaged in the learning process, if they know what engaging learning feels like, and they want to do that as something that is a fun thing in your life. And this is the same as everything. If you force kids to read, they're going to stop reading. If you force kids to play an instrument, as my friend's parents did, they'll get older, they'll stop playing. But if you make them passionate about that, if they love reading, if they love playing music, if they love learning, they will stick with it their whole life. So I see the real task of teachers in the future, I mean, I think it's been that in the past too, but is to really get that engagement. And to that end, the engagement is much more important than the content. Now, some of the differences that I've observed in the young people that lead us to this, the way we want to think about different things differently, is an increase in the speed that people are used to taking in information and making decisions. You know, think about the kids who are playing racing games and flying games when they're little, and they're taking in information and making decisions at the speed of those pilots and drivers. Random access, so that the old 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 is gone. Start at the beginning, get to the end. Now, what do you do with logic? Good question, right? Because there's still various logical things, but logic is different in a programming world, and we have to sort of think about how we change our way of presenting logic to people. Another one is doing more than one thing at the same time, whether you call it parallel processing or multitasking. This is definitely a preference for seeing multiple data streams coming into you at once. It's really boring if only one data stream is coming in, even if it's coming from me. But we're all immigrants here. We have to figure out how to make that happen and how to make it work. Kids hate filtering. They want to see all the data, and they want to filter it themselves. There's a big change in the relationship of text and graphics. I grew up, many of you grew up, in a world where text came first as the presentation method, and then graphics illustrated that. It's now the opposite. Text backs up graphics. The atmosphere that people expect has changed a lot from a very work serious, or I guess a work-oriented atmosphere, to a play, because they're both serious. Games are about winning, beating the competition. You can be very serious about your play and about your games, but they're not thinking of work, and we'll talk about that more this afternoon. And finally, how do you deal with the fact that this is a generation and a world that now takes connectivity for granted, and that connectivity is free, and that connectivity is with the entire world? How do we take advantage of that, bring that into what we do? So, faster random access, many things at a time, graphics-led, play orientation, connectivity. Those are some of the things that we have to think about as we start to remod. But there's a lot more. Scary how much there is, actually. This is, I don't mean for you to read this whole thing, but all the things that are in yellow are things we all do, right? We all communicate, we all share, we all buy and sell. What's in pink is the way the digital natives do it differently. They've invented new ways already to use the technology. So they're, you know, we may email or telephone, they IM and chat, and they use the blogs and the webcams and all these things. We have to study all those things, because those are the kinds of things that we're going to have to put into our courses. Now, can I, you know, just tell you there's two or three? No, there's a whole lot of them. And I have articles online of this called The Emerging Online Life of the Digital Native. It's real important we think about these things. And I'll make sure you get all these slides when you leave, and you can figure out, look at a lot of this stuff on your own. You know, even things like transgressing is different these days. You know, I used to get my pornography under the bed. You know, you'd find a magazine or at the library. Now you just go online. You know, it's real easy. So everything that is happening in this digital world, the natives are making up new ways to do things. If their relationships are going to be online, they need to invent reputation systems to make sure they understand who they're dealing with and what their reputation are. They're evolving. If they're gaming, they're coordinating, building things, it's unbelievable the amount of coordination that kids are able to do in their gaming world and in their other worlds online without us. You know, we think we're teachers, adults, we're so necessary for some of these things. In the digital world, we're not necessary. We're often in the way. So we have to think about those things. We have what's called a digital immigrant accent. Things like, I mean, the laughable part is printing out our emails, but the important parts are not instant messaging. We don't communicate the way the kids do. You know, imagine a class, and who was the elementary school person here? You are, there were two, right? Imagine a class where you ask the kids to pull out their cell phones and the whole class takes place in instant messaging, right? And what could you do with that? And how could you think about that? Well, that's something digital natives would love, right? If you could figure out, and we can talk about that, how to do that, that would be neat because it would be using their language to do something that we want to do. But it takes some thought to figure out how you would figure that out. Not going to the internet first, you know. I mean, we have these rooms of books. In one class I saw, it was wonderful. They had all these textbooks, and the only thing they used them for was to hold up the computers. And that's kind of the way the world is. But there are interesting issues about what's right and what's wrong and what's real and what's not real. How many of you are familiar with Wikipedia? Okay, for those of you who aren't, it's an online encyclopedia that's written by individuals. So you can go to any article and change it. Or if an article on something that you know about doesn't exist, you can write an article. And there are questions about that as to its validity. So what happens in a lot of cases, certainly in the States, I don't know about here, teachers and librarians ban the kids from using it. They say, oh, it's not written by an expert. How can you trust this? Well, what we've got to start to learn is how can you trust this? Certain articles, certain areas are viewed by so many people and over again changes are made that they're probably very trustworthy. Other things may be written by only one person and may be totally wrong. How do you start to evaluate this are kind of things that we need to do. How do you take the tools and not ban them, but use them and learn to use them and learn to take our knowledge as adults, as experienced teachers, as whatever we have, and fuse that with what the kids are doing faster than the speed of light. Thinking real life happens only offline is a real barrier to us because we need to think, you know, a lot of digital immigrants think face-to-face is the only way to go. It's the only thing that really counts. And for the kids, it's not. Online is just as real. Even sometimes more real. It has its own problems, it has its own things, but it keeps people in touch in a way that didn't used to happen in the past. There's a great line about a young girl who comes back from college for the first time after she's gone away to another place, and her mother says, I've gotten all your friends together so you can see them again. And the girl says, Mom, I am with those kids every day. You know, I'm in touch with them. Kids are staying in touch much, much longer and much more frequently than they ever did before. And they can help each other in many ways. And one of the phenomena that we're seeing is that people that while in our generation, information was something to be kept to yourself and hoarded because you might be some value in it later. You were the one person who knew this. You could use it at the right moment. That's not the way the kids see it. They say the value is being the first to show that you have it, therefore the first to put it online. So it's a real sharing culture. And we need to use that sharing part of the culture in our education so that it's not us teaching them, it's them sharing and hopefully teaching each other with our help, things like that. The idea of kids now wanting to put their own mark on things, wanting to create. This goes back to Tim Berners-Lee. Everybody know Tim? Should know Tim's name. He invented the World Wide Web. Brilliant guy. He said years ago that what counts with the web is not what you get out of it. It's what you put into it. And that's a real important thing. We spend a lot of time in education teaching people to search. You know how to teach people to search. People know how to search. You want people to be able to create. And that's what the kids want to do. They want to put stuff in. So that's a big change in thinking about how you put it up there. When you put it in, other people can find it and use it and share it. And that's real, real important. This is a real important thing. How many of you think of yourselves as programmers of any kind? Okay, a few of you. Every one of you is a programmer because every one of you does Google searching. And every time you go do a Google search, you're programming. Every one of you writes a Word document. When you write a Word document, you're programming. If you download ringtones, if you change anything on your cell phone, you're programming. That's what digital technology is all about. It's about making the devices do what we want them to do through programming. Now, what we don't realize this so much, but the kids realize it a whole lot. Now, when it comes to advanced programming, we're back in the Middle Ages. In the Middle Ages, if you wanted to write a letter and you were a normal person, you couldn't write that letter, right? Because you couldn't write. You'd go to a scribe. Today, if you want to write a program, you have an idea that you want to make something do something, you can't write the program. You have to go to a scribe or a programmer. So the programmers today are like the scribes of old. We have to change that. We have to make sure everybody at every level can program, starting at the elementary schools, in languages like Flash, in other things. We have to say, make the tools do what you want them to do. Because people are thinking about this. In the States, a good example is when Howard Dean was running for president. And he had this idea, why don't we collect money online? Right, which nobody had ever done. Well, how do you do that? You write a program. So you go to who? An 18-year-old, and he writes your program in less than a week to do this. So that's the kind of thing that we have to think about. In all our courses, we need to think, what programming is involved in this? How do you get multiple data streams? What data do we need to be in this course? You know, and that even goes through for history or anything else. Perspectives. Different perspectives around from around the world. How do the Chinese look at the Nanking Massacre versus how do the Japanese look at the Nanking Massacre? You know, how does one group look at 9/11 versus how does another group look at 9/11? So we need to think about how you can bring all those data streams from around the world, whether they're informational data streams, numerical data streams, whatever they are, how do you bring them into? Well, because the kids are going to be sitting there with computers ready to deal with them. It's, you know, we're the problem if we don't do that. Here's this, I love this quote. You know, why should I study when I can build? Right? There's a game called Caesar 3. It's about architecture and building. It's also about history. You go out and you build the Colosseum and you build all these things. Well, that's what we have to do. That brings things, when people are doing this and building and creating, it brings it to life for this generation. So again, no matter what your field is, how do we make this stuff happen? In the game world, player production of content is becoming increasingly important. How many of you know about The Sims? Okay. How many? Now, I just heard, I didn't even know, Havo Hotel. How do you spell that?
H-A-B-B-O.
Okay. See, now that's why I come. I learn. Is it in English? Or is it in Dutch? Or is it in?
It's in Dutch, but it's also.
It's in Dutch. Okay.
It's also international.
It's also international. Those kinds of things where you build stuff, you buy stuff, you do the. Who's making that stuff? Increasingly, it's the players, it's the people who are involved. They create the tools. Sometimes the makers create the tools, but increasingly the kids, the players, create the tools and then they make the stuff. And that's so important. You can't have a course these days that kids are going to be interested in if they're not making stuff and adding to a repository. And making stuff is wonderful because if you can make it and you can put it up online, every year you get more of it, more of it, more of it, more of it. So you have a greater bank of things that you can use. And you can go on and do them. And then another big thing in games that we don't have enough of in education is the system. Is a system where not only do you have a game in the middle, but you've got it surrounded by contacts, mostly online, but online and off, where you are getting reviews of the game, you're seeing what the fans are creating, what people say about it, the magazines, the blogs, the chat, that everybody is involved in conversation in one way or another about whatever it is you're teaching. And that is something that we need to be creating. And we need to be creating it, not each one of us for ourselves, but we need to be creating it worldwide. So if you're teaching fifth grade math, you know, or algebra, or you know, European history, there are resources around the world that you can go to where everybody studying that goes to. And they're all contributing. And gradually things are building up. And those kind of things are not in place yet. They need to be in place. Part of the reason they're not in place is that we don't share enough in our generation. So that whereas we do a lot of things, my guess is that every single person in this room, by virtue of the fact that you're here, has done something, probably lots of things, that are interesting, that would be useful to others to know about. Am I right? Yeah. Okay, I'm going to assume I'm right. Now, of those things, how many of you have put what you've done that's interesting online for somebody to find in Google? Yeah, that's what we have to do. Though, congratulations to those of you who have. Those of you who haven't, you've got work to do. Because the best tool, the single biggest tool that we have in the world today is Google. And if you're doing something interesting and another person can't find it because you haven't bothered to put up an HTML page or post it on a listserv or done something that lets people know, then the whole world is impoverished by the fact that you haven't done that. In terms of games, it's important to distinguish, I think, between two types of games. And we hear a lot about genres, we hear a lot about violent, nonviolent. Here's the distinction that I think is important. Mini games, which is most of what we see today, what most of us grew up with, games that take less than an hour or two to play, games that are little games that are online, there's millions of them online, some of them are educational, some of them are just fun. Those are mini games. Now, we think of them as games, because we grew up with mini games, right? Card games, board games, stuff that was roughly pretty trivial. In fact, Trivial Pursuit, you probably have it in Dutch, you know, is the big game, right? Those are, at the very best, those games can be good, but they're one-noted. Chess is even a mini game. Checkers, it's the same game over and over again. It has lots of ramifications, which makes it a fun mini game, but it's a mini game. If you compare that to what the kids play today, it's totally different. I invented this term complex games just because there's no term for it. But for a game that has so many levels that takes you hours and hours and hours to play, typically more hours than a course, right? A course is typically 30 to 40 hours. So the kids are playing a single game for more hours than a course. We need to think about how do you create games that are, or learning games, that are of that length and that are still interesting and that are fun. And as we will say, well, I'll show you in a minute what we need to think about. So a lot of us don't understand those games. A lot of us have never played those games. A lot of us don't know what a game is where you've got hundreds of people each sitting at a different computer playing, trying to do something simultaneously, where you're struggling to get to level 50 of something, right? And you've been playing at this thing for weeks and weeks and weeks. So this is a very, very different thing that's important for us to know about, because that's when the kids say games, they don't mean mini games. And that's a real confusion. We hear, how can I use games? And everybody's thinking, how can I use mini games? Because that's what we know. But the kids are thinking, how can we have real games, complex games, that are as good about education as the ones that we want? And we're just starting that. I'm trying to work on an algebra game, as some other people are. Reading games, curricular games.
That's a question.
Yeah.
What's the rule of flow in these big games?
What's the rule of flow? I don't understand the question.
The rule of flow. Like the children have while doing these big games, and because you need a certain concentration to focus on this game?
That's a good question. Do kids concentrate on games? The answer there is duh, right? I mean, they sit there and play these games for hours and hours. This is what parents are so, you know, upset about. So clearly something's going on. How do they do that? We'll get to it in a minute, but let me come. There are a number of things that they do. One is that they have clear goals that we're about to talk about here. Another, and they're goals that you want to reach, that they make you want to reach. Another way they do it is by leveling you up little by little to the goals. Another way they do it is through the feedback that you get. And another way they do it is, and this is, speaks especially to what you asked, is through the artificial intelligence. Because what we're doing with AI is we are exactly keeping you in the flow zone. So we want every minute of every game for every player, ideally, as a game maker, to be, I want you to feel at every minute that you have, that where you're trying to get, you understand. You think you can get there if you only work hard. You know it's a little bit of a struggle, but you don't feel like it's too hard for you. You know you can get there, and you will get there. And then as soon as you get there, I'm going to make it hard for you. If it's too easy, I'm going to put blocks in your way. I'm going to take away some of the easy things that you have, or I'll put up barriers. If it's too hard, I'm going to give you helpers, or I'll give you more health, or I'll give you extra things. That's what we do as game developers. We're very good at keeping you in that zone and making you feel like that game was designed just for you. And we're at the very, very beginnings of doing that in education. Now, that's what tutors do, right? That's what a tutor is supposed to do, is to say, okay, I get where you are. I'm going to give you the next problem that's just going to challenge you a little. But it's very hard to do in a classroom when you've got 40 people or, you know, something like this. So the game AI is very, very, very good at that. And that's something that we need to get more of and learn about how to do more. In terms of the goals, I went back and I said, what are the goals that the top-selling games give kids? Right? Because what are our goals? Learn European history. Great. You know? Learn to factor. Why? Here's what the goals the games give kids. Be a hero. Overcome. Use your, you know, you be work with your friends. History is in your hands. Rise through the ranks. Create, customize, and control. You know, tell your own stories. Mixed genes. That sounds pretty interesting. That's The Sims 2. Meet your friends. Tackle a quest together. Your accomplishments have an influence on your future. That's what the kids are going home to do. Those are goals that are pretty worthwhile. How can we recast the goals that we have as educators into terms like this? That's another big question for us as we mod. We need to recast our goals. Question?
Maybe. If the kids go through this, to what level or to what degree do they realize that they are going through it? Is it reflective in the sense that they afterwards can maybe denote some strategies they have played or reflect on the things they have supposed to have learned in the game?
Well, that's a very interesting question. First of all, you could take this anywhere, because rise through the ranks to general could be rise through the hospital from you know, intern to orderly to chief surgeon. So you could do this in any kind of a context. Reflection is a very interesting question. And conscious reflection is an even more interesting question. Because as teachers, we want kids to do conscious reflection. Why? Because if they don't, we can't talk. We have nothing to talk about. Right? That's what we expect students to do. Is conscious reflection necessary for learning? We have no idea. In fact, I think you can make good arguments that it isn't always necessary for learning. So here's a good example.
Yeah. Make a report.
on what you're going to do, which steps you're going to make, and what goals you're going to make in the game. They tried to record it, and after they recorded it, it all went better, and the game played, yeah, went better, and they got better results than when they don't.
And clearly there are points when that helps, and that's the way we teach, in a sense. We force people to reflect out loud, consciously, at a slow pace. But, and that's, I'm not saying that's bad, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't do it. I'm just saying there are other things that happen. So, for example, you may be a game player, other people. When you finish a game, and you die, you don't finish it, but you die in the middle of a game, and you're about to start the level over, what's going on in your head? What did I do wrong? What did I do this? How did I do it? How can I do this better? What can I do? You are doing that whole after-action review or debrief or whatever it is very quickly, not very consciously, typically, in your mind. And that's kind of the thing that we want to do. So that the idea is that the process is important. Verbalizing the process may or may not be important. Are there ways, given that we have technology to help us, that we can increase the pace of this reflective thing and make things happen, make the same loops, and everybody knows that there are learning loops of reflection and doing and thinking about it, and they call them the OODA loops, they call them various things. That's pretty clear now. But what speed do those loops have to go at? Well, hopefully, you know, if you're a jet pilot, those loops better be going very, very, very quickly. If you need to transfer things and learn how to do things, sure, you need to practice that. But you don't need to necessarily, you know, draw it out to the point of boredom. And we have to be careful in the time of everybody moving so fast and doing these things, that we do the things that we do at a speed that's commensurate with what the learners are expecting and how they can do it. So, you know, I mean, one of the people said, there's a quote that I liked. They said, well, when you're doing this in games, you don't have to wait for the teacher to catch up to your brain. Right? And if the kids in our classes are waiting for the teacher to catch up to their brain, we're in big trouble.
One more question, this point of goals.
Yeah.
But probably it's an answer, a question that you can't answer, but at least you would have an opinion about it. It was a discussion we had yesterday that children may get so much involved in games that they can't translate it to the real world that much anymore, in the sense of that they think that they, in real life they're also going to be hero or just rising up the ranks or whatever, and that they hardly understand that it takes them a lot more effort and a lot more things than just playing a game and so on. And the whole idea of the relationship between the game and realism and the effects on personality and those kinds of things.
Well, there are a couple of things. There's a lot of things to say about that. I mean, one thing is I hear... And I hear this again and again and again. It keeps making me laugh harder and harder. That they say, you know, we really should teach kids that life is not fun. And I'm thinking, they're going to learn that. They don't need us to teach that to them, right? They're going to learn about disappointment. They're going to learn about this. What we need to do is to give them the opposite. And to, you know, I would rather that the kids go out there thinking they can be heroes. And finding, you know, so much of what goes on that prevents you from moving quickly in life is real bullshit, you know? And it may be real bullshit. I mean, it's world, it's people, it's influence, you know, it's people standing in your way, it's things. But the kids know that these days, you know? It's really, one of the things that I've observed that's really interesting is that when you go online, you know, one of the big things in the world that nobody talks about, there are a lot of these things. One of them is lookism, right? The fact that how you look really determines what goes on in the world. Tall people have higher salaries. They do better. Good-looking people get certain advantages that other people don't get. It's true, folks. We're not allowed to talk about it, but it's true. Online, you don't have lookism, right? So the kids often love that they don't have to suddenly worry. And, you know, the classic line is, online, nobody knows if you're a dog. But there's another form of lookism that's happening. And that's, how does your work look? So if I go to your webpage and it sucks, I think you suck. You know? It's a different form of looking. You may not suck at everything, but you have to learn to present yourself. It used to be you wore the clothes and the stuff like this, and you did the makeup or whatever. Now you have to learn to design your online world so that people are attracted by it and that they think that you succeed. And what that means is that somebody can say, if you have, you know, a phenomenal web page and a phenomenal set of stuff out there, you can succeed even if you're 10 years old, because people will see what you can do. And that's a real different world. And the kids know that, or they're starting to know that. You know, in the, I don't know how it is here. Do any of you know about MySpace? MySpace.com? It's a place where you go and you fill out a criteria and you put up anything you want if you're a kid. You can all sign up for it. I'm up there. When kids go on dates or when they meet each other, before they go, they check out MySpace. If you're not up there, that says something about you already. If you are up there, what does it look like? How much stuff is up there? What do I know about you? Blind dates don't exist anymore in that world. Right? So it's a real different kind of world. You know, why would you not have a class where everybody put up something online and then you talked about it and evaluated each other and thought about this? You know, that's real important going forward. There's a lot of stuff that we know now, and I'm going to just put this up here as reference, and you can find it in my books and other places. We know why games engage people. We know why people learn from games. A lot of this is the work of a guy named James Paul G, or Jim G, from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who's the co-author of this book. We know what they learn, and I like to summarize this as how to do things, what to do, why to do it, where to do it, and whether to do it. And the whether level is really, really important, because that's the ethical level. Just because you can hit somebody over the head with a baseball bat in a game, should you? Just like in life, folks, we'd better be discussing that stuff. So we know that in much more detail, so that we know that kids are learning strategy and morality and ethics and identity and flow and all these different things that they're learning in their games. They tell us. It's not like they don't know that they're learning this stuff. Even the younger kids know it. Right, risk-taking has really changed. We have a whole generation now of prudent risk-takers. And there was a whole book that was just about this called Got Game, published by Harvard Business School Press. This is what gamers have. This is business, folks. That's what you do in business. And as a result of that, the kids have new attitudes. You know, like don't be afraid to fail. Winning matters, work in teams, take responsibility, all those things that you see up there are important attitudes that come out of gameplay. And they have to do with everything that we are trying to teach and impart and consult and whatever it is to the kids. Asking questions, bringing the kids' life is really important into learning. Even if you know nothing about games, if you don't know the name of a single game, you can always ask, who plays a game that relates to what we're discussing? So somebody can say, you know, you're talking about negotiation, and somebody will say, you know, in this game, we had to do this huge negotiation, and then you can say, well, how did it work, and how does this, you can start bringing this into this thing. Can you think of an example of this in your games? You might be a language teacher talking about irony, or talking about something else. Games have this stuff, and it's all there. It's the point of reference for the kids. It's not like you say, what book did you read this in? Because You know, it's what game did you learn this in? Who wants to write a game report and talk about the ethical issues you dealt with? Those are the kinds of things that we can be bringing in. Value what the kids do. Now let me talk a little bit. This is going on longer, but I think, is this useful? We'll vote. Okay. Anybody finds it not useful? Take a break. When we talk about game design, here are the things that are really, really important. It's that we focus on the engagement. If I'm a game designer as opposed to a teacher, I sit down there and I say, how can I keep you people in your seats for 20 hours, 30 hours, 40 hours? What's going to do that? You know, I don't say, what content am I going to give you? What am I teaching today? I say, how am I teaching today? Right? That's a very different perspective. A real difference between what we normally do in education and what we do in the games world is decision making. They count it. How often do you think the average person asks a question in a classroom? And this is in America where we probably ask more. Once every 14 hours was the answer. Some people ask a lot. Most people ask none. We don't have people making decisions in our classrooms. If you play a game, you make a decision every half a second. If you play a slow game like chess, you got a clock to force you to make decisions. Right? Decision making is really important because it's fun. And it really helps you learn stuff. So the real question of how do we increase decision making in classrooms? And there are strategies that people have had, like, something I'm about to say in this lecture is wrong. Find it. So then you've got to listen to every sentence I say. Is that the right one or the wrong one? Or every time I ask you a question, I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand. I'm going to ask everybody in the room to vote on whether it's A, B, or C. Every question I ask, I want you to make a decision on and commit yourself. So there are various strategies that people have used in the past. We need to think about how to bring more decision-making into the learning. The idea of leveling up is one of these, like, genius things that somebody thought of to get people to practice. Practice sucks in most things, doing something over and over again. I used to be a musician. I can tell you firsthand, practice sucks. But you have to do it. So what did I do? I invented games, you know? What do they do? What do we do in the games world? We say, okay, if you want to get from level 40 to 41, go out and kill 1,000 orcs. Right? Now, you don't want to kill 1,000 orcs. But you want to get to level 41 because there's privileges you get when you're at level 41. There's things that are worth, it's worth being level 41. So people have told me time after time, young people and adults, I went out and killed 1,000 orcs. And now I'm happy. Well, what that means is killing orcs is just a metaphor for practicing something, right? I went out and solved 1,000 equations. I went out and, you know, learned 1,000 vocabulary words. I don't care what it is. People do it because they want to level up to get, and why do they want to level up? Because the goals are worth it. So that's a, you know, that's brilliant. All that means is that we have to recast our curriculum in terms of these mini little levels that people can move up. So, you know, and that most of that's done. It's just the chapters, you know, in some way. So that's a thought. The adaptivity I talked about in terms of you, right? We need to, the games, what they do so well is they adapt on the fly, not in advance, to each person by sensing. I can sense in the game how long it takes you to make a decision, how much reading you want, how much information you want. You know, before you make a complex decision, are you the kind of player that likes a lot of information? Do you want to talk to everybody and see everything? Or do you just make them, you know, very quickly? The nice thing about that is not that I can play to your style, because frankly, I don't care about your style. I want to play against your style. If you need a lot of information, I'm going to make sure you don't get any. If you are the person who likes to make decisions too quickly, I'm going to make it so that you need to get all that information before you can make a decision. I'm going to teach you. That's how games teach. Not by making it going with your flow, but by forcing you to do things that help you learn and do things differently. And this one is just really, really important. When we're making a game and we get to a prototype, which we do very, you know, like at some times even once a day, sort of once a week, we say to people, we give it to people to play, as many people as we can, and then we ask them one very technical question. What sucked? What was bad about this game? How can I make it better? How many teachers at the end of a lesson say to the class, okay, that was my lesson, folks. What sucked? How can I make that better? What should I do for the next class that's different? You know, why was it bad? You know, I don't care why it was good. Tell me why it was bad, what I should change. We don't iterate in education. In fact, somebody writes the notes for a lecture and they can use them for their entire life. If they ever teach that course, out come the same notes, right? They read them. It's like, you can't do that anymore, folks. Beep. And then the last part that's really important is that the emphasis is not on the way it looks. And somebody asked the question about, is it expensive, is it hard? You know, I guess that was your question. Most of the expense in creating the commercial games is the eye candy, is the way it looks, is the graphics. Most of the interest that the kids have in playing the game is not that. That's just a barrier, that's something that looks nice, we expect it. But if you're making a game, what you want to do is have good gameplay. And that means continuous decision making, leveling up, pacing, complexity, choices, all the things that we've been talking about. That's what keeps the kids. And there's evidence for that, that works, and the evidence is overwhelming. The evidence is called the Game Boy. Everybody remember the Game Boy? Especially the little first one? No eye candy whatsoever. Sold 200 million units. Because all those games on the Game Boy were forced to have good gameplay. They were forced to be fun. And again, I'll give you these things, you know, so you'll have access to them. But if you're going to compare teachers and students, and I'm talking about old-style digital immigrant teachers and new-style digital native students, because nobody fits clearly 100% into every group, remember that. But teachers are used to presentation, students want gameplay. Teachers are used to linear stories, students want random access and branching options. Teachers want one thing at a time, students want multiple data streams. Teachers love to do things in person, here, and the kids like to do a lot of the stuff online. So as you move to the right, you get more engagement. We're going to break in 5 minutes for this thing. So. Same thing in terms of curricular design. The focus, content versus engagement. The mode, presentation versus gameplay. The decisions, rare versus frequent. Move to the right, you get more engagement. And in general, I don't tell people to move to the right. But in this case, I do. Now, here's a big one, and this is one that this sums up a lot of it. The problem with this thing called instructional design that we put into so much of our online learning, and whoever asked the question about how we can improve our online learning, is that it sucks the fun out. Right? Sometimes you hear this big vacuum cleaner. Out comes the fun. It's education, kids. You know, check your fun at the door. Or as the kids say, power down. You're going to school. Fun can be, in the games world, fun is the art of mastering a problem. It's solving something. That's what's fun in games. You've got some kind of a problem, whether it's a puzzle, whether it's a relationship, whether it's a quest, whatever it is, you've got to master that. That's the fun. So it's not so far away from what we want to do in education as some of us may think it is. I'm going to also talk to you a little bit, I'm just going to go through this real quickly, but how do we use our mobiles? We all have them. Every single one of our kids has them. How do we use them? They're really powerful. They're really optimized. They do so many things. You know, they have cameras in them. They have GPS in them. They have the internet in them. How do we use them in education? If we're not using your mobiles in your classes, then you better think again. And there's so many things we can use them for. Even if we just use them voice only. Forget the screens. or voice only and text messaging only. There's so many things we can do. You can even assess. In Britain, they're having people talk into the phones, and they're assessing with the voice print that it's the right person. So these are the challenges, folks. You know, focusing on the engagement, the decisions, the leveling up, the iteration. Those are the challenges that you're going to put into the courses when you mod them. And here's a big reference if you like it. If you're a digital immigrant and you like words, this is what it looks like. Don't show that to a kid. And here are things that people have thought about. And one of the things I do in these workshops is I keep a list of what have people had for suggestions. So creation of things like media, because, gee, you have your phone. It may actually, and a lot of these phones take video, amazingly enough. How do we get competitions or contests or projects or content? You know what? Let's take a break, because I think it's probably time. And when we come back, I'll show you the list, and then we're going to invent some more of our own. Okay?
Okay.
Thanks. 15 minutes, people.